Discovering Journeys, the podcast where individuals from all walks of life come together to share their experiences. I am your host, Sujala, and in each episode, I bring you unique perspectives from those who have embraced change and growth. Whether you're seeking inspiration, fresh insights, or simply curious about different life paths, this podcast will connect you with journeys that resonate and inspire. Please note, the content shared on this platform is solely for educational, informational, and entertainment purposes. The opinions shared by the guests are their own personal views, as it is based on their personal journeys and should not be construed as professional advice. Thank you. In today's episode, I am honored to have Terry Tucker as our guest, a man whose life exemplifies courage, determination, and purpose. He's a speaker, author, and founder of Motivational Check, whose life is a testament to courage and adaptability. With a career that spans roles as a basketball player, marketing executive, hospital administrator, business owner, and even a SWAT hostage negotiator, Terry's path is as diverse as it is inspiring. For the past 12 years, he has faced his greatest challenge yet, a relentless battle with cancer, emerging as a warrior. Terry's journey is one of overcoming adversity, finding meaning in the hardest moments, and using life's trials to inspire others. Through this conversation, he shares invaluable lessons. This episode is more than just a story. It's a powerful guide to resilience and the strength of the human spirit. Get ready to be inspired by the extraordinary journey of Terry Tucker. Hello, Terry. Welcome to my podcast and thank you for being my guest today.
Well, Sujala, thanks for having me on. I'm really looking forward to talking with you today.
You are a college basketball player, then marketing specialist, hospital administrator. So what drew you to become a SWAT hostage negotiator?
Yeah, that's a great question. If you kind of look at my resume, it sort of looks like a Super Bowl went off in the room. It's all over the place. But if there is a backstory to it, and if you understand the backstory, it makes more sense. And the backstory is this. My paternal grandfather was a Chicago police officer. Chicago's one of the bigger cities here in the United States, from 1924 to 1954. And in 1933, he was actually shot in the line of duty with his own gun. It was not a serious injury. He was shot in the ankle. But my dad, who was an infant at the time, always remembered the stories growing up that my grandmother told of that knock on the door of Mrs. Tucker, grab your son, come with us, your husband's been shot. So when I expressed an interest in sort of going into law enforcement, following in my grandfather's footsteps, my father was, absolutely not. You're going to college. You're going to major in business. You're going to get out, get a great job, get married and have 2.4 kids and live happily ever after. But that's the life my father wanted me to live. That's not the life I felt I was supposed to live. So when I graduated from college, my dad was dying of cancer. So was my grandmother. But I had a choice. I could have said, hey, Dad, I know you're dying. Sorry about that. I'm going to go do my own thing, blaze my own trail. Or out of love and respect for you, I will do what you want me to do. So my first two jobs were in business because that's what my dad wanted me to do. And I sort of joke. I did what every good son did. I waited until my father passed away and I followed my own dreams and became a police officer.
For how many years were you a SWAT personnel?
I was on SWAT for 4 years. I was in law enforcement for about 10 years.
Okay. Was there any particular situation that you're not able to shake it off even today that you remember it?
I mean, there was a situation with a young man. This is a person who wanted to commit suicide. He wanted to die. And it started around dinner time. So he ended up slitting his wrists and that didn't work. And then he thought by turning the stove on, the oven on, he had a gas stove and sticking his head in the oven, somehow that would kill him. That didn't work either. And then he called a family member and the family member called the police. And so it's probably 3-4 o'clock in the morning now. And I'm talking to him and he's got a gun and he gets to a point where he says, you know, Terry, I'm really tired. I want to come out. And I'm like, yeah, do that. Put the gun down, come out, and you and I will talk face to face. We've been talking on the phone to this point. We'll talk man to man, face to face. I said, bring the phone with you. I told him what was going to happen. I said, but don't hang up the phone. He ended up hanging up the phone, which is not uncommon. We're trained that when a conversation is over to hang up the phone. About 30 seconds later, one of the tactical officers that had surrounded his house came on the radio and said, we heard a gunshot. And I thought, you didn't shoot yourself. He did. He shot himself. But he shot himself, and I think it was more of a hesitation kind of shot. It was like, you know, I really don't want to do this. And the gun went off, and the bullet went in underneath his skin right by his temple and went around his skull and came out the other side. Never penetrated his skull, never got to his brain. And the reason I remember this is it's, you know, we always talk about when it's your time to die, it's your time. And there's nothing you're going to be able to do about it. But nobody ever talks about the opposite of that. That if it's not your time, there's nothing you can do that's going to make it your time. I mean, this guy had tried three different ways to kill himself during an evening, and none of them worked for him. So it was a very bloody injury, but it wasn't a very serious injury. And we got him to the hospital and got him fixed up and stuff like that, and then got him the mental health help that he needed. This wasn't somebody that needed to go to jail. This was somebody that needed mental health assistance. And we were able to get that for him.
Wow, what a story. And you had to face this pretty often. How did you take it personally?
Yeah, and that's a great question. And my sanctuary was home. You know, there were a lot of times after a call up and we would all get together and we debriefed after every call up, no matter how many hours it took, what went right, what went wrong, what can we do better next time? And then a lot of it was, hey, let's go out for a drink or let's go to the bar or something like that. And I love these people. I would have given my life for these people, and I know they would have given their life for me, but it was never, hey, I'm going to the bar with you. I'm going home, because that's where people care about me. That's where people love me. That's where the people support me. So that was my support system, not going out drinking, not trying to dull the pain with alcohol or drugs, but going home and being around people that I loved and people that loved me. And I didn't discuss a lot of it with my wife. Our daughter was small, so I didn't discuss it with her at all. But I mean, I would just sort of give my wife the high level stuff about what happened. And then I would just be home. And that kind of rejuvenated me, sort of recharged my batteries to be able to go out and do it again, just being around the people that I loved and that loved me.
The community support comes so much in handy, isn't it, in situations like this and handling it as well?
Yeah, it does. And in law enforcement or first responders in general, fire, EMS, law enforcement, you see a lot of things. SWAT is... I mean, it's the worst of the worst. I mean, if we get called up, something really bad has happened. But just the everyday things that I saw as a police officer, it was man's inhumanity to man. It was people do, you know, it was evil. It was bullying. It was violence towards other human beings. And you were there to try to clean the mess up. And so you saw a lot of things in law enforcement that most people shouldn't see. You don't want to see that. So you need to be grounded in some way. And for me, that grounding was my faith and my family.
But how did you learn to detach yourself?
You know, I don't know if I did. I felt the pain that these people were going through. I felt the sadness. There were times it was like, I know I have to take this person to jail, but this person doesn't need jail. This person needs mental health services or addiction services or something like that. So I could empathize, for lack of a better term, with these people and still be able to do my job and still be able to be safe and protect myself and my partner. So it wasn't that I tried to not feel the pain. It was, I'm going to feel it. I'm going to understand it or try to understand it. But again, I have something that grounds me that doesn't pull me in or suck me into that, you know, well, I've got to dull this pain by alcohol or drugs or bad behavior or whatever it ends up being. So I had something that was that grounded me.
That's great that you found that space. It's so, so important. At what age were you diagnosed with cancer?
51.
And it's been a 12 years journey. Whenever you hear such adverse situations in a family, the first hurdle I feel is the acceptance stage. So how did you and your family process this news?
Yeah, I mean, when I found out I had cancer, you know, I mentioned my father had died of cancer at a very early age. He died at 54 of end-stage breast cancer. And one of the things I learned from watching him go through that was I was going to do everything right in my life. I was going to see my doctor every year and have whatever tests he or she recommended. I was going to eat right. I was going to exercise. I was going to get enough rest. All the things that we know to promote health. And then one day I was coaching girls' high school basketball and I had this callus break open on the bottom of my foot. Eventually it doesn't heal. I go to see a podiatrist, a foot doctor friend of mine, and he takes an x-ray and tells me, Terry, I think you have a cyst in there and I can cut it out. And he does. And he shows it to me. It's just a little gelatin sac with some white fat in it. No dark spots, no blood, nothing that gave either one of us concern. But fortunately or unfortunately, he sent it off to pathology to have it looked at. And 2 weeks later, I get that call from him. And the more difficulty he's having explaining to me what's going on, the more frightened I'm becoming. Until finally, he just laid it out for me. He said, Terry, I've been a doctor for 25 years, and I have never seen the form of cancer that you have. You have an incredibly rare form of melanoma that most people think of is too much exposure to the sun. Mine has nothing to do with sun exposure. It appears on the bottom of the feet or the palms of the hands. And so now I'm in this, I've got this cancer. It gets cut out, and the surgeon tells me you'll be dead in 2 years. We don't have anything to offer you. Thought, okay, you gave me a death sentence. Maybe I can try to turn that death sentence into a life sentence. But when I was diagnosed, I went through, I'm 100% sure, I went through all the stages that we would associate with grief. You know, first was denial. I can't possibly have cancer. I've done everything right in my life. Then it was anger. I can't possibly have cancer. I've done everything right in my life. And then there was a bargaining with God. Our daughter was in high school when I was diagnosed. So it was like, hey, God, please let me live long enough to see her graduate. And then I got down, I got depressed, and then I just came out the other side. And it was like, this sucks, but I'm going to have to embrace the suck. I do not like the cards that I've been dealt, but I'm going to have to play these cards to the best of my ability. And I think disease, any kind of disease, whether it's chronic or terminal, tends to initially isolate us from our friends and then our family and then ourselves if we let it. And so my wife and I, you know, we kind of banded together and it was like, all right, our daughter's in high school. We made a decision. We're never going to lie to her about something that happened. You know, dad's got to have surgery. Dad's got to have his leg amputated. Dad's got whatever it ends up being. I mean, we obviously told her things age appropriately, but we never lied to her. And she was included in decisions. And my wife and I were just like, all right, my wife is a stoic Norwegian, you know, from Norway. And is like, she has supported me for 12 years. She cooks for me. She cleans for me. She drives me places, everything. And without her, I wouldn't be here right now. So this is definitely my disease, but it's a family affair when it comes to fighting this disease. I mean, you mentioned I'm a cancer warrior. So is my wife. So is my daughter.
Yeah, truly. Professionally, what changes happened once you were diagnosed?
I haven't worked since I started. I mean, like I said, I was told I would be dead in 2 years. They initially put me on a drug called interferon, which I took a weekly injection of. And the side effects of the interferon were that I had terrible flu-like symptoms for 2 to 3 days every week after each injection. And I took those weekly injections for almost 5 years. So imagine having a terrible case of the flu every week for 5 years. And that wasn't a cure. That was, as my doctor used to say, we're kicking the can down the road in the hope of buying you more time. Eventually, the interferon became so toxic to my body that I ended up in the intensive care unit at the hospital with a body temperature of 108 degrees, being alive. But somehow I survived that. But then I had to have my foot amputated in 2018. I had to have more surgeries in 19. I had to have my leg amputated during the COVID pandemic. And I still have tumors in my lungs. So this has just been a constant, constant, constant process. And you just have to steel yourself, get ready for whatever comes next. And again, like I said, if it hadn't been for my faith, my family, and my friends, I just don't think I'd be here right now.
For a person to endure the pain, one is the physical pain and another one is the emotional pain. Physical pain, people can count the number of injections, people can count your visits, but they can't count your emotions because it's so much you. It also makes you that vulnerable emotionally and not in a good way. So in this whole time, were you able to share emotionally?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I think you're absolutely right. You have to find meaning in your misery. There has to be something that clicks in you that says, okay, I'm going to go through this and I'm going to be emotionally up and down. I mean, I'm still treated for the tumors I have in my lungs. And when I have those treatments and I'm treated for an entire week, every 3 weeks. And so Mondays I react at home. So my wife sees, you know, my nose is running. Half the time I'm crying because you're right. The physical pain really makes you emotionally vulnerable, you know? And so, yeah, I cry. I feel sorry for myself. I get down. I do all that. And I don't care if I'm sharing it with a nurse or I'm sharing it with my wife, you know, or my daughter. It's like, this is the way I am. I will recover from this. And that's one thing I know, this will get better eventually. I mean, it may be hours or maybe the next day, but eventually it will stop. And I just hang on to that, you know, eventually it's going to get better. Even if I die, it'll get better. You know, that I won't have that pain anymore. So yeah, I share this with everybody. I mean, not just my wife, but with the nurses, with the doctors, with the therapists that take care of me. I share the emotional part as well as the physical part.
Yeah, that's beautiful to hear, because you often hear that, you know, men cannot share emotionally. So it is so refreshing to hear from you that you share it. And I think for men who are listening, it is so important to know that when you share emotionally, it's not that things are going to change, but it's just going to make things smoother for yourself and also for your loved one who is looking at you, because they are not kept in the dark.
You're right. I mean, they're as afraid as I am, but I'm the one going through it. They're the one that has to sit and think about it and wait to see how this is going to turn out. So I have no problem. I don't think sharing my emotions or crying or feeling down from time to time makes me any less of a man and you know, any less of a provider or whatever I'm supposed to be, a husband, a father, a friend. I don't think it makes me any less at all. I think it makes me more of an individual, that I'm strong enough, that I'm tough enough, that I can share that vulnerability with other people and let them be part of my life. Let them be part, you know, it's like, no, stay away. You know, I got to handle this myself. Nobody, I don't care what your job is. I don't care what your disease is. I don't care what you're going through in life. Nobody does that successfully by themselves. We need each other. If COVID taught us anything, it's how much more we need each other. All that isolation didn't do anybody any good.
Where did you find this fighter spirit in you?
That's a great question. I think it's a combination of things. It's a very strong faith in God. And I use, you know, people ask me, well, you know, who do you blame because you got cancer? I'm like, what do you mean, who do I blame? Well, we've got to blame somebody. We're great at, you know, at failing or having something happen and not taking responsibility for it. We got to blame somebody. And I've had all 88 genes that I have in my body tested for every form of cancer that we know about, and I have no mutations in any of my genes that would predispose me to any form of cancer. And yet I got this incredibly rare form of melanoma. And people want to know why. I don't know why. Nobody's ever been able to tell me why. So I don't spend a lot of time worrying about the why. But when I was on interferon, when I was taking those shots every week, I was so sick of being sick that I prayed to die. I wasn't going to kill myself or anything like that. But it was like, look, God, there are sort of two camps. There's the living and there's the not dying. I was not living. I was not contributing at all. I mean, a good day for me was literally being able to get out of bed and go to the couch or the sofa and sit out. That was a good day. I know, and that sounds pathetic, but that's how I was living. If you would have asked me my goals, I would have been like, well, if I wake up tomorrow morning, I'll just try to get through the day. That was literally how I was operating. Obviously, God did not take me, but he has given me the strength to go on. And I look at my disease as, I think God can take my infirmity, my sickness, and use it to show other people his comfort, his mercy, his love, his healing. And so I'm like, use me. You, however you want to use me, God, use me. And then the other part of it was my family. I have a very strong family that allows me to be strong. And I'll give you just a quick story. When my doctor, when I had these tumors in my lungs and I had my leg amputated, my doctor wanted to start me on chemotherapy. And I remember saying to him, is it going to save my life? He said, probably not, but it might buy you some more time. And I said, well, if the end is going to be the same, if I'm going to die, whether I take chemo or not, then I would prefer not to take it. But I'll go home and talk to my family. So I go home and I start telling my wife and daughter what the doctor wants to do. And my daughter's immediately, all right, we need a family meeting. I'm like, family meeting? There's three of us. It's not like we got a board here or something like that, you know? So we sit around the kitchen table and individually talk about how we feel about me having chemotherapy. And then when we're done, my daughter, once again, all right, let's take a vote. How many people want dad to have chemotherapy? And my wife and daughter raise their hand. I'm like, wait a minute. For something that I don't want to do. When I was back in the police academy, our defensive tactics instructor used to have us bring a photograph of the people we loved the most to class. And as we were learning different techniques to defend ourselves, we were to look at that photograph because he reasoned you will fight harder for the people you love than you will fight for yourself. But because I love my wife and daughter more than I love myself, and in hindsight, it was the right thing to do. It was the bridge that got me to the drug that I've been on for the last 4 years now.
That's such a beautiful story. Let's talk about your support systems. I feel there are three parts to it, three supports, you can say. Financial support, emotional support, and your people support. Because 12 years is really a long time. To have something so constant is truly admirable. So yeah. How did you navigate?
It does. I mean, financially, we had very good health insurance. So I wasn't denied anything. There was nothing that really our family had to go in debt for. So the health insurance aspect, you know, not having to worry about that was a tremendous relief for all of us. And that was just because my wife's job offered a great health insurance. The emotional part of it, I talk about faith, family, and friends, and I really haven't spoken about the friends part. I mean, when I got cancer at 51, there were people that I was 100% sure would be there for me, that, you know, I could count on. And some of those people were like, I got to back away because you're too young, you're too vibrant of a person to think that you're going to be dead in 2 years. I can't deal with that. But there's also people, Sujula, that I never expected to be with me through this journey who have never left my side in these 12 years. So, you know, that friends piece of being able to support me emotionally, you know, that I could just call up and be like, you know, hey, I'm having a hard day today. All right, let's just talk for a while. You know, it's nothing spectacular. It's not like they're, you know, flying in and doing anything like that. It's just people you can count on.
Yes.
And so I've just been lucky to have that sort of umbrella of financial, emotional, faith, whatever you want to call it, people in my life that have allowed me to just concentrate on fighting the disease and not have to worry about all the stuff on the peripheral that, if I had to deal with that, would certainly make doing this fighting much more difficult.
Oh, that's like tremendous that you have a great set of people around you. That's like a huge, huge help. It boosts you mentally and helps you to fight even harder.
Yes. And it also allows me, when I meet people that are in my state, hey, I'm here, you know, call me. It's okay. You know, I mean, you sort of, at least for me, it's reciprocal. You know, if I can find somebody that needs that help, I'm here for you as well, not just other people being there for me. I try to pay it forward as much as I can.
What were your lowest days look like?
I mean, they were pretty bad. They're, you know, I found out that I was going to have my leg amputated and that I had tumors in my lungs on the same day. And it was right in the middle of COVID. And so all surgeries had shut down. And so my doctor had to lobby to get my, you know, they're like, well, you know, the tumor had broken my leg, broken a bone in my leg. They're like, just put it in a cast. It's like, you don't understand. The tumor's still there. It's not going to heal by putting it in a cast. And so I remember the day I finally had surgery to have my leg amputated, I was not allowed to have anybody with me. My wife literally dropped me off at the hospital. There was a nurse waiting in with a wheelchair. I got in the wheelchair. They wheeled me back to the pre-op area. And if you've ever had surgery, pre-op area is a large room divided up into different bays, all designed to be prepping people for different surgeries. And so, Julia, I was the only person in that whole room. I was the only person having surgery that day. It was me, the nurse who brought me in, and an anesthesiology resident. And I was scared to death. And I was told that I'd be in the hospital for 10 days to 2 weeks to learn how to function without a leg. They sent me home after 48 hours, having just had my leg amputated above the knee. And we weren't ready for that. I wasn't ready for that. My pain still wasn't under control. But it was, again, having a very stoic wife. We'll figure it out. We'll figure out how to, we'll rearrange the house so that, you know, you're in a wheelchair, you're in a walker. Okay, we'll figure it out. We'll make it work. We didn't just kind of fold and say, oh, this is terrible. You know what? There's nothing we can do about it. No, we're going to figure it out. We're going to figure out a way to make this work.
Oh, she's your rock.
She is. So yeah, that's pretty much, you know, how I got through, you know, even my darkest days was just with the help of others. It wasn't anything I did. It was leaning on my faith, my family, and my friends.
Emotionally, what was the worst thoughts you had apart from, you know, that you will die?
Yeah, you know, it got to a point where, you know, every time I went for a scan, it was sort of like getting a report card when you were in school. You know, were the tumors going to grow? Were they going to go somewhere else? You know, was I going to have to deal with that? And something my doctor told me was, no matter where the cancer is in your body, it's already been there. Technology is great and it allows us to see tumors, but the tumors have to be the size of a garden pea, which is about 1 billion cells. So if they're smaller than that, we can't see them. Just like I had, you know, it was like 8 years before they found the tumors in my lungs. They were always there. It was just too small to be seen. So, you know, I kind of got this thing like, well, if I can assume that I'm going to get bad news, that the tumors are going to grow or they're going to go somewhere, then I'll be able to steel myself and ready myself when that happens. And if I get good news, then that's even better. But once my doctor told me that, it was like, look, you don't really have any control over where the cancer is. Nothing you're going to do is going to make it go somewhere or not be somewhere. Like, okay. So I got out of my head with, like, I could control this. I couldn't. I realized I have really very little control over when I die, you know, when this disease progresses, where the tumors are found next. Very little control over. So I don't spend a lot of time worrying about the dying part of it. I spend much more time thinking about living the life that I'm supposed to live. There was a Native American Blackfoot proverb that I heard years ago that I absolutely love. And it goes like this. When you were born, you cried and the world rejoiced. Live your life in such a way so that when you die, the world cries and you rejoice. That's what I want. Don't get me wrong. I'm not looking to hasten my demise in any way, but death is not nearly as scary for me because I believed I have lived the purposes for which I was put on this earth to do.
How did you build such a resilience? Because 12 years is really long. To have that day by day, it's not easy.
No, it's not. And as I said, you know, I have those bad days when I feel sorry for myself, when I get down, when I cry. But I find a lot of times when I'm in those states, I'm looking internally. It's, you know, well, woe is me. Look at this terrible thing that's happened to me. And I find a real easy, a real simple way to get out of that is to go and find somebody else, you know, call one of my friends that has cancer. Hey, how's it going today? Now, all of a sudden, I'm not focused on me. I'm focused on another person and trying to make their life better. Or if I'm at the hospital, you know, I'm in a big infusion center with, you know, 40, 50 patients at a time. There's always somebody that I know or that I saw in the waiting room that I can reach out to. Hey, how's it going? How you doing today? Now I'm not focused on me. I'm focused on somebody else. And, you know, I think for sure that social media allows us to sort of stay on the surface with people. And there's a professor at the University of Chicago, a psychology professor here in the US, who does an experiment with his students. And the idea is to go out and get on a bus and in three questions, be deep with somebody. So you get on a bus, sit down next to somebody. Hey, how's it going? Oh, it's going fine. That's question one. Question two, and I'm just making this up. What do you do for a living? Oh, I'm a doctor. Okay. Question two. Question three. Have you always wanted to be a doctor? No, I grew up on a farm and I wanted to be a veterinarian, but X, Y, and Z happened. Or yeah, my mom died when I was 40 and she was, or when she was 40 and she was a doctor and I wanted to make her proud. So I became, whatever it is, whatever the answer to that question is, now you're deep with somebody. Now you're, why do you do what you do? Whatever it ends up being, you'd be a garbage man, you can be a doctor, whatever it ends up being, why do you do what you do? Now we're deep with somebody. And for me, that's incredibly important now. I love to go deep with people. I love to ask people about their lives and what's going on in their lives because it just, one, it makes me feel good just getting that connection with another human being. And that really is something that keeps me going all through this journey.
How did you become a motivational speaker?
I never really did. I just had enough people that started to make that suggestion to me that you've done some things in your life and you've done a lot of things over this 12-year cancer journey that maybe people would resonate with or maybe people could learn from, and that if you offered that to them, maybe they would glean something from it. So, like I said, I started this motivational speaking business just as COVID hit. And all of a sudden, you know, okay, everything dries up. There's nobody doing anything in person or even virtually at that point in time. Zoom and things like that weren't things that people were using. And so I'm like, okay, I want to do this, but I don't know how to do it now. And a friend of mine had reached out and said, hey, would you like to be a guest on my podcast? And I said, sure. What's a podcast? I had no idea what a podcast was. And he explained it to me. And I thought, well, okay, it sounds interesting. I'll try it. And Sujula, I was horrible. I was terrible. You know, I had post-it notes all around the camera. I would lean in and I would read the post-it notes when he asked me a question. I provided no value. But then I stepped back and I was like, well, the first time I ever drove a car, was I any good at it? No. First time I cooked a meal, I think I burned the water. You know, I mean, the first time I studied algebra, I was not any good at it, but I wanted to be good at it. And so it was a matter of what's the best way to do that? And I heard somebody say once, never make a point without telling a story, and never tell a story without making a point. So it was like, okay, I've got things to say. Now I've got to have stories that go along with those things. So it was a matter of either from my own life or from things I've read or heard about, developing stories that illustrated the points that I wanted to make. And so I've done a lot of podcasts, but now that things have opened up since COVID, now I can use that same formula and speak to people either virtually online or in person when I have that opportunity.
I'm so glad that you decided to, you know, take it forward, because your story, your journey, and your spirit needs to be heard.
Thank you.
Do you believe that mind game matters way too much in this whole journey of yours?
I think it matters the most, because if you can't control your mind, I mean, our mammalian brains are set up to avoid pain and discomfort. You know, they tell you, you know, stop doing that. It hurts. It's uncomfortable. And we listen to it. But the way you get better, the way you improve, is you do things that make you uncomfortable. And I will recommend this to your audience. I do this every single day of my life. Do one thing at least every day that scares you, that makes you nervous, that makes you uncomfortable, that's potentially embarrassing. It doesn't have to be a big thing. But if you do those small things every day, when the big disasters in life hit us, and they hit all of us, we lose somebody who's close to us, we unexpectedly get let go from our jobs, we find out we have a chronic or a terminal illness, you will be so much more resilient to handle those things than those people who never step outside their comfort zones, who never do anything that challenges them. So I think you really need to control your mind, or your mind is going to control you. So it's just like a marathon runner. We hear about this all the time. You're running a marathon. At some point, you will hit a wall and be like, oh, I don't think I can go on. This is too hard. And that's your brain telling you that. But you find, or what people tell us, I've never run a marathon, is that if you keep going, if you just try to put one foot in front of the other, eventually you'll kind of get that second wind and you'll be able to finish the race. That's a metaphor for life. You know, you're going to hit obstacles in your life. If you can push through, if you can keep moving forward, you'll eventually push through those obstacles and more than likely get to where you want to be.
Yeah. The mindset has become such a hot topic now. Everybody wants to know about how to shift your mindset. Is it something you believe can be learned?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. But it's a very simple thing to do, but it's very hard because you're working against yourself. You're working against your own brain. And that's a hard thing to do. You know, you have to understand that this is a negative thought, that this is something that's not good for me. How can I change that and put it into a positive thought? Because we all become what we think. And the interesting fact about this is that, and you know, you mentioned I was a college basketball player. So if I took a basketball and went out onto the court and I practiced shooting free throws, let's say, and if you could look at my brain under an MRI, there would be a spot somewhere in my brain that would light up when I would be doing that. The interesting thing about that is, if I thought about taking that basketball and going out on that court and shooting those free throws, that exact same area in my brain would light up. So whether you do it or you think about it, you are engaging your brain. So if you tell yourself enough times, oh, you know, I'm terrible at algebra. I can't do algebra. There's no way I'm going to pass this. If you keep all that negative, eventually you're going to hardwire your brain to the point where, yeah, you're right. You can't do it. You're no good at it. But the opposite of that is true. If, you know what? I can do this. I can make this happen. I can find a way to overcome this. If you do that enough times, eventually you'll program your brain where, yeah, this is just an obstacle. I'll find a way to get over this obstacle.
Is it possible for somebody who have not gone through adversity to develop these things?
I mean, my initial answer is no, but I don't want to make that an absolute. I mean, maybe there is some part, but the only way you're going to grow, the only way you're going to get better, the only way you're going to improve is to step outside those comfort zones and do things that make you uncomfortable. I mean, if you just stay in your comfort zones, you're never going to get better because you're never going to push yourself. You're never going to try something new. You're never going to have a different mindset or a different perspective, or your muscles are going to grow because you work them in some way to exhaustion. So unless there's difficulty, unless there's adversity in your life, it's very hard to grow in your life. And if you're not growing, then in all honesty, you're dying. You know, we're either growing or we're dying. It's like a tree. The tree's either growing or it's dying. It's not plateauing. Having said that, let me say that life is not linear. We don't start here and then just get better. We start here and get better, and then we plateau, and then maybe we get worse, and then we get a little better, and then we plateau again, and then we get worse. But as long as the direction is taking you in the path that you want to go, there's a good chance you'll get there. But it's not linear. It's not like I'm just going to get better and better and better and better and better. It doesn't happen that way. You're going to have to face that adversity, face that difficulty in your life to make you a better person. I know I am. I absolutely know I am. And, you know, I've learned a lot from cancer. And one of the things that I've learned, well, two of the things that I've learned is, I don't think you truly know yourself in life until you've been tested by some form of adversity. And secondly, cancer has made me a better human being. You know, I've been asked if you could live your life over again without cancer, would you? And honestly, I don't think I would, because it's made me the person I am today. That adversity has made me a better human being.
You really believe that with the mind and doing the uncomfortable things, you can conquer?
I do. I mean, one of the things I do when I take a shower is I turn the water at the end of the shower to as cold as it possibly can be. And cold therapy is kind of in vogue now. Now, I think the science is still out whether or not it's something that is that beneficial. But if nothing else, what it does for me is, this hurts. This is uncomfortable. I don't like it. And you know what? Next week, I'm going to go to cancer treatment and I'm going to face difficult, uncomfortable, painful times. So taking a cold shower for me allows me or prepares me to face that adversity that I know I'm going to face next week when I get my therapy. So that's why I do these things. It allows me to prepare, I guess. It's like practicing for a game. Why do we practice? Why don't we just play the games? Well, you practice because you don't want to make the mistakes. You want to make the mistakes in practice and not make them in the game. Same thing with me. I want to feel this uncomfortableness now so that when I have that adversity next week at treatment, it's not nearly as bad as if I had not done anything to prepare.
What a great perspective you have. We are towards the end of the episode, and I would like to ask you three questions, as I always do in my podcast. The first one is, what is the biggest lesson you have learned in terms of human strength and connection?
I guess I'll say this, and if your audience remembers nothing other that I've said, remember this, because I think this is incredibly important. It's more important who you work with and who you work for than it is the work that you do. Find people in your life that care about you. Find people that are willing to invest in you. Find people that want to see you succeed. Hitch your wagon to those people and climb your mountains together.
Incredible. Three things you wished somebody had told you during this whole journey of your cancer.
I think number one, the importance of hope. That no matter how bad things get, no matter how horrible you feel, how much pain you're going through, if you know you're doing the right things, that maybe not today, maybe not next month, maybe not even this year, but at some point in time, there's a good chance you will get to wherever you want to be. I mean, for me, it's illness. For some people, it's starting a business, you know, having a relationship, whatever it ends up being. So hope is number one. Number two, I would say, and this is going to sound kind of bad in a lot of ways, the old Stoic philosophers used to talk about the Latin phrase memento mori, which means remember death. Remember that you're going to die, not for the sake of death, but for the sake of living, for the sake of finding your purpose in life and living that purpose. I think death is something that should always be sort of in your peripheral vision. It's always there. It's kind of hanging out over here. I don't focus on it a lot, but I know it's there because it helps me to live a better life. So I would say those two. And then I guess the last thing I would say is this. We all have a breaking point. Don't get me wrong about that. But I think that breaking point is so much further down the road. We quit. We give up. We give in long before our bodies need to give in, because we listen to our brains. Our brains tell us this hurts, this is uncomfortable, stop doing this, and we listen to it. Your body can handle so much more than you ever thought it could. And if you don't mind, let me give you a quick story. It happened back in the 1950s at Johns Hopkins University here in the United States. There was a professor who was doing an experiment with rats. And he put rats in a tank of water, and he wanted to see how long the average rat could tread water before it sank and drowned. And the average rat treaded water for about 15 minutes. And just as those rats were getting ready to drown, he reached in, grabbed them, pulled them out, dried them off, and let them rest for a while. And they took the exact same rats and put them in the exact same tank of water. And the second time around, on average, those rats treaded water for 60 hours.
Whoa.
Now think about that. The first time, 15 minutes. It wasn't like you were going to flunk a test or your business was going to go under or your marriage was going to fail. You were going to die. Your life was going to be over. And the second time around, 60 hours. That's how much more you've got to offer yourself. That's how much more your body can handle than you ever thought. You'd quit after 15 minutes. Your body could go to 60 hours.
Wow. What is the one or more lessons you want to pass on to the next generation?
I guess I'll quote a line from a book that I absolutely love that I think is a great metaphor for life. The book is called Farewell to Arms. It's written by a man by the name of Ernest Hemingway. And the book is sort of a semi-autobiographical account of Hemingway's time as an ambulance driver for the Italian army during World War I. And there's a line in the book that goes like this: life breaks everyone. And afterward, many are stronger at the broken places. So understand, and we've talked about this already, things are going to break you in your life. But if you can keep moving forward, just like if you were to break your arm and the doctor would set it and put it in a cast, when it heals, that area that was broken will be stronger than the rest of the bone in your arm. Same thing for life. When those tough things happen, when that adversity happens, if you can push through, if you can keep going moving forward, you will emerge on the other end a stronger human being.
Thank you so much, Terry. It's been so motivating and inspiring at so many different levels that I can't even tell you.
Well, to Julia, thanks, Frank.
So thank you so much.
I was just going to say, thanks for having me on. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Discovering Journeys. I would love for this podcast to reach as many people as possible. So please remember to subscribe, rate, and leave a positive review. Share this podcast with someone you think who would appreciate this conversation. Check out the show notes for all the links and details. Until next time, keep embracing your journey and discovering new paths.